Immigration has been a hot-button issue this election cycle, with views from supporting a path to citizenship all the way to those in favor of a big, beautiful wall. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll learn about the Define American Film Festival, starting today in Des Moines, running through Saturday. Ahead of the Iowa caucuses, it gives voters diverse perspectives about immigration and American identity. Then we'll find out how Iowa's kids are doing, as reflected in the latest Kids Count data. And finally, we finish up with political analyst Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. She has a new book out that captures the feeling of the Iowa caucuses going back decades. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For years now, and especially during this election cycle, immigration has been a hot-button issue, and we hear arguments across a wide spectrum of opinion, from supporting a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, all the way to those in favor of a big, beautiful wall on our southern border and the deportation of millions in our country. In this first half hour, we want to focus on the Define American Film Festival. That's this week in Des Moines. The festival begins this evening, runs through Saturday, and through a selection of six feature-length narrative and documentary films, those who attend this festival will have a look at the immigrant experience across a range of cultures. Screenings will be followed by panel discussions featuring the filmmakers, actors, and experts as well. Joining us this half hour to talk about the festival is the founder of Define American, Jose Antonio Vargas. And Jose, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
We want to mention, Jose, you're a journalist, founder of Define American. That's a nonprofit focused on immigration issues. It was your June 2011 essay in the New York Times Magazine that won you a Pulitzer Prize, My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant. And you have a film titled Undocumented in this film festival. Michaela Schwer is with us as well, a director of the film Don't Tell Anyone. That's a documentary in this festival about the life of an undocumented activist. Michaela, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Jose, let me start with you. It's no coincidence this festival comes just days before the Iowa caucuses. What do you hope this festival will add to the political discussion buzzing just ahead of the Iowa caucuses?
Well, I mean, I think Donald Trump takes credit in trying to put immigration at the center of this election. I think he succeeded in doing that. Unfortunately, putting it in the center doesn't necessarily mean knowing anything more about it. The conversation is way too simplified. And we don't have enough context, and we don't have enough facts. And the goal of this festival, you know, at its core, is to really humanize the issue and to present a vast array of stories. There isn't one immigrant story. I mean, the segment that just preceded this one talked about actually the decreasing number of undocumented immigrants in this country. By the way, is anybody telling that to the Republican candidates? I seem to hear more and more that they think people are just climbing up the wall every second. And so our goal with this festival is to insist on the humanity and the complexity of the immigrant experience. And I cannot think of a better place to do that than in Des Moines here in Iowa, just days before the Iowa caucuses.
Okay, we want to focus on Michaela's film here in a minute. But Jose, give us an overview of the five other feature-length films that will be here so we can get an idea of the diversity you bring to the screen.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Tonight, we're actually opening the film with a special screening of A Better Life. This was nominated for the Academy Award in 2011. Damien Bashir, the actor who played an undocumented gardener in Los Angeles, is coming here tonight to present the film. He's in the new Tarantino film, The Hateful Eight. And Chris Weitz, who directed the film, is also going to be in town. Tomorrow, we're actually showing The Joy Luck Club, which is a groundbreaking film showing the Asian American experience here in the United States. Asian people are actually the fastest growing immigrant group in America, documented and undocumented, but that's not something you hear about every day. We're also showing a documentary called The Muslims Are Coming. And it's this really interesting documentary about Muslim American comedians who try to grapple with and tackle Islamophobia and go to the South and talk to Americans about what it means to be Muslim in this country. We're showing another film called Mother of George. It's about a Nigerian immigrant couple in Brooklyn. Yes, black people are immigrants too. And the goal here, as I said, is again to kind of present these vast array of stories. I'm particularly proud to show a short film called Ellis Island that features Robert De Niro. One out of three Americans, including many Iowans, can trace their ancestors through Ellis Island. So just the variety of those films, I think, really tell you what we're hinting at here.
Jose Antonio Vargas with us this half hour, founder of Define American, talking about the Define American Film Festival this week in Des Moines, starting tonight on through Saturday. Michaela Schwer, director of another film to be shown at the festival, Don't Tell Anyone. We have a little clip of that from the trailer in just a moment, but why don't you set it up for us, Michaela? Tell us a little bit about Don't Tell Anyone, how you latched on to this story.
Sure. Don't Tell Anyone follows the story of Angie Rivera, who, when we meet her, is already a very outspoken and documented activist who runs also an online advice column called Ask Angie. And the film really follows her and her mother's journey, really, from coming from Columbia to Queens, New York, and then their relationship as Angie steps out of the shadows as undocumented and becomes very vocal about it. And then she also reveals, is outspoken about sexual assault that happened to her, which is also very common among the undocumented community. And it's also something that I think people feel that they should stay quiet about and don't get help for. So
Well, let's listen.
Really emotional journey through their relationship together.
Let's listen to a little bit of the trailer. And we hear this transition also reflected in the trailer from the stay silent, stay in the shadows mentality that this activist, Angie Rivera, grew up with, into coming out to talk about the plight of undocumented immigrants. Let's listen to this. Is a bit of Don't Tell Anyone.
Being undocumented isn't something we can put in the back of our heads. When I wake up, it's the first thing I think about. Sometimes in my dreams, I'm undocumented too. My mom raised me in an environment where speaking out about your status is wrong. She taught me the same fear. No le digas a nadie, she would say. Don't tell anyone. But I started seeing things differently.
Undocumented is just a label, but it doesn't define me. I dream of a world where I'm free to travel, to drive, a world where I'm an equal.
I understood that you could do something to change your reality or the way that you were undocumented.
Already as an undocumented student, you already feel like you're not in control. We can't vote, and then we already fear that we're going to be deported. We have no control over legislation and all these things. So then it also feels like, oh, okay, I don't have control over my future and my education either. But that's not true. It took me stepping out and saying, this is happening and I don't know what to do. Is there any help out there?
Okay, there's a little excerpt from Don't Tell Anyone. That's an undocumented immigrant activist, the profile of Angie Rivera. Filmmaker is with us, director Michaela Schwer. It's a very moving, just in the trailer that I saw, very moving. At one point, Angie, Michaela, perhaps you can tell me about filming this scene. Angie is holding up a series of note cards, and one says, people feel they can treat me like crap. So she's written things on these note cards about messages she wants to deliver. Another one says, they call me illegal. We deserve to be here, alive. And you see tears in Angie's eyes. Tell me about shooting that sequence. And she also calls it a psychological war, which I found interesting.
Yeah, and that actually isn't something that we shot. That's something that Angie shot herself. She has her own YouTube channel. So that's actually one of the videos she made on her own, which is also a big part of the film. You know, she was really already doing so much with her advice column that we just really tried to utilize that within the film. But I think it was a really emotional piece that she did, and it resonated with a lot of people on her YouTube channel. Because I think these are issues that people don't really remember, that you're dealing with someone, and the name calling that's out there really affects people. And, you know, this is a young generation, but it affects everyone when you call people illegal and, you know, you say horrible things about them. It really does, I think, affect your psyche.
Michaela, how do you come to this topic? How do you come to be so concerned about undocumented immigrants?
I'm a first-generation American. My parents immigrated from South Africa, and I grew up in Arizona. So immigration has just always been something that I cared about, but I also realized I didn't know anyone personally in the undocumented community. And I read a story about Angie in New York Magazine in New York one day, and really something about her, you know, her in an advice column that tackled really day-to-day issues that I had never thought about, I thought was really interesting. And I met her and really just, you know, fell in love with her and her family. And we decided together, you know, working with her, that we really thought this could be an important piece to put out there to the public.
As a filmmaker, Michaela, as a documentary maker, do you see yourself in this case as there as part of the cause that Angie is out there for as well? Or are you a neutral storyteller?
You know, I mean, I certainly want to always be neutral in terms of journalistic ethics, but I certainly, in this case, you know, I am an advocate. I want to be a strong ally. And the story really is about Angie's story. And there's no way for me to be neutral in that, because I just believe in her so much and everything that she's doing and her community's doing. So, you know, it certainly is, you know, trying to advocate for Angie and the needs of her community.
What has been the response so far when you've shown the film and talked to people who viewed it? What kind of responses do you get?
It's been pretty incredible. I mean, we get a lot of emails. Angie's, you know, her email is out there. People tweet at her. You know, there's obviously some really nasty things that are said to her. But she's really good at kind of dismissing that and moving forward to the positive. And people have come forward to say, you know, this film really resonated with me, and this is my story too. So thank you for sharing it. I feel like I'm not alone. Because there's a lot of people that still don't talk about it, and everyone needs to come out in their own way. But I think to see stories not only like Angie's, but, you know, like all of the other films that will be at the Defining American Film Festival and many others that are out there, I think it just helps to see more and more of these stories out there and in the press. And having these conversations.
Jose Antonio Vargas, founder of Define American and behind this Define American Film Festival this week in Des Moines, I want to ask you, it has to be a problem that you feel much of the time in a festival like this, for instance, that you're preaching to the choir. You're talking to people, you're showing films to people who are already aware of the themes that you're raising.
You know, I used to think that. I used to think that about films. But having traveled as much as I have in the past 4.5 years, I don't think that anymore. It always surprises me, by the way. It doesn't take a Republican or a Democrat or a progressive or conservative to have really inaccurate information when it comes to this issue. I was just, for example, at the Harvard Club in New York. When was this? 2 weeks ago. And this is the Harvard Club, right? In like midtown Manhattan. And after I gave a little 5-minute talk, actually talking about this film festival, this woman comes up to me and she's like, "I am so embarrassed. You know, I thought I knew about this issue. What do you mean you can't see your mom? I mean, I thought there was amnesty." Because, you know, you hear about – it's been really interesting being in this – being in Des Moines now for a few days and looking at the television ads. Shouldn't there be, by the way, some sort of a fact check on these ads that the candidates are running? You know, amnesty is not on the table. There is no amnesty, right? I mean, Angie Rivera, for example, I mean, this is why I love that film, because I think it exposes the intersections of issues, right? Like, Michaela's film doesn't just look at Angie as an undocumented young woman. It also looks at her as a young woman, right? And the intersection between immigrant rights and women's rights. And so I don't see that. I don't see that when it comes to this issue, I'm not quite sure that there is a choir. I think there is the great majority of Americans who don't think it's their issue, you know, who don't think that it's a priority or that it's urgent, mm-hmm. right? I have to say, by the way, your comment about one of the questions you asked about being a neutral storyteller, I don't think that's possible. And I actually think that's what's been fascinating about the rise of social media and technology. This is why Angie Rivera's, you know, column, Ask Angie, really hit a nerve, right? I mean, I remember researching this when I was still in the closet about being undocumented. And I found out about this young woman who's like the Dear Abby for undocumented people. I'm like, isn't she supposed to be hiding? Like, how can she have a YouTube channel, right? So this whole idea of people being agencies of their own stories, having agency, being able to tell it and say that this is my story. I think that's what's been fascinating about, you know, the rise of social media and also the importance of filmmaking right now.
Jose Antonio Vargas, founder of Define American, and his film Undocumented will air as part of the Define American Film Festival this week in Des Moines, beginning tonight through Saturday. I wanted to play a little clip from a trailer of another one. You mentioned it earlier, Jose. The Muslims are coming. This is a takeoff to a very old film, at least it's a reference to a very old film called The Russians Are Coming, yes. I assume.
Yes, it is.
I enjoyed that as a kid during the Cold War era. But here it is, The Muslims Are Coming. And this is these are comedians who take to the stage to deal with this experience, cope with the atmosphere they find in through their comedy. But first, let's listen to kind of the opening of this to get a sense of the context that is set for these comedians.
Make no mistake about it, Islam is a violent religion.
Is there a Muslim problem? Look what's happening.
We are dealing with a culture that is in its medieval era.
These are young, angry terrorists who want to kill you, and they want to kill me, and you know it. Stop with the PC crap.
Can I invite you to a stand-up comedy show? It's absolutely free. It's tonight at 8 o'clock. It's called The Muslims Are Coming. There's a bunch of Muslims on stage, but they're hilarious.
Okay, we get the idea. There's the setup, Jose. Talk about this film, because it deals with – we can – it's funny to combine comedy with this. We have, you know, Syrian refugees. We have terrorism. San Bernardino, for instance, in the recent news here. How do we understand a film like this? We strike a balance between having a compassion for war refugees, for instance, and protecting your community, my community, the country, against a very real threat of terrorism.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, but terrorism is not just international terrorism. It's domestic terrorism. Right. I mean, I would argue that a lot of white supremacists who have been shooting, you know, like, for example, like the young man who was responsible for killing 9 people in Charleston. I mean, that was terrorism. Right. I think it's just important to contextualize these issues. But you were asking about comedy. I am a firm believer that, you know, comedy is such an important tool. In some ways, it can be a real, you know, a real provocative and uncomfortable way to discuss issues that we don't want to discuss. And that's why I thought that their angle, their take to this, you know, the filmmakers who are both comedians themselves, I thought they did a really masterful job striking that balance, right? I mean, I think of that film as like kind of the original Kings of Comedy Muslim edition. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to really resonate with people here.
Now, we've seen during this political season a real backlash against political correctness, whatever that means. And at the same time, Define American makes a big point that our rhetoric is important. We heard that about that in Michaela's film there, the titles of Undocumented versus Illegal. Talk a little bit about the importance of language in this immigration debate, the policy.
Language has really been at the heart of Defile Americans' mission, right? The words we use frame the conversation, right? And it's been really kind of fascinating to watch as I travel across the country, you know, in places like Alabama, Arkansas, Ohio, Wisconsin, and the way people understand this issue. How do you legalize people you call illegal, by the way? You don't. You call them illegal. End of the conversation, right? And then once you kind of, you know, step back on that and unpack why people think that, and then you try, and then you start to understand that, you know, the average American, because it is a complicated issue, doesn't really understand how the immigration process works. They think all we have to do, people like me who are undocumented, they think all we have to do is go to an office, fill out a form, you know, bump somebody off the line, and poof, I'm an American taking their welfare away from them. It doesn't work like that. It's been fascinating just figuring out the number of, like, assumptions that people make, that I get health insurance, right, that I get some sort of government subsidy, that I vote. What am I going to vote with? I have no papers. That's why I'm undocumented, right? Like, if I go to a polling booth, they're going to kick me out because there's no way for me to prove that I am who I say I am.
Mm-hmm. With all this celebrity, what is your status? Still undocumented? Do you want to do anything
about
it?
I don't know about the word celebrity. I mean, I think the goal here for me has been trying to be kind of a trying to expose the system as much as I possibly can as a journalist and as a filmmaker. But yes, I'm still undocumented. I'm one of the 5 million people who would be impacted by the Supreme Court decision that's going to come, you know, in the next few months about whether or not people like me would be deferred deportation. Now, mind you, like, you're talking to an incredibly privileged undocumented person, right? While people are hiding for their lives, here I am in Des Moines hosting a film festival at the Des Moines Arts Center. So I'm just using every possible skill and resources I have to insist on the humanity of this issue, and that is our goal.
Mm-hmm. Circling around to where we started here, this coming just days before the Iowa caucuses, first in the nation test of presidential candidates. Of course, you mentioned Manhattan and other parts of the country. Manhattan, much, much more, one of the most diverse parts of our country. Of course, Iowa has become more diverse, but still one of the least diverse states in the country. A lot of people could say, well, the issues covered in these films don't really apply here to Iowa. How do you respond to that?
Oh, they absolutely apply here in Iowa. You know, the Latino population in the state has grown more than 100% in the past decade. The Asian population in the state has grown 100% in the past 2 decades. That's why we're showing, you know, Asian-oriented films and Latino-oriented films. What I did not mention, by the way, is we opened the film festival with a premiere of a short documentary called Undocumented Iowa. I just came here to Iowa 3 months ago and filmed that. There's about 40,000 undocumented Iowans who live here, who call this state their home. The presidential candidates talk about them a lot, so we figured why not give them, you know, a space to tell their story. So absolutely, these issues and these demographic changes apply to the state.
Okay. As we finish up the few seconds here, tell us how people can attend, where people can find out.
Please. All the information is on Define American Film Festival. DefineAmericanFilmFest.com. That's where you can find all the information.
DefineAmericanFilmFest.com. And the cost of attending these films?
Free.
It's free.
Absolutely free. But seating is limited, so please go online and check it out.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jose Antonio Vargas, founder of Define American. The Define American Film Festival starting up this evening in Des Moines, running through Saturday. Michaela Schwer, thank you very much, director of one of the films featured in the festival, Don't Tell Anyone. Thank you, Michaela.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jose.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out how Iowa's kids are doing as reflected in the latest kids count data. And then finally, we finish up the hour with our political analyst, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. She has a new book out that captures the feeling of the Iowa caucuses going back decades. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. Welcome back to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk with Rachel Caulfield, one of our regular political analysts of Drake University. She has a new book about the Iowa caucuses. That in just a few minutes, we'll talk with her. But first, today the Child and Family Policy Center, that's a Des Moines-based research and advocacy organization, came out with its latest Kids Count data on the well-being of Iowa children. This annual accounting looks at indicators of child well-being, data in the areas of health, education, family stability, and economic success. Joining us now to comment on the latest data, Ann Disher, Communication Director and Senior Research Associate for the Child and Family Policy Center. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Ben. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you. Some may be hearing about Kids Count for the very first time. Before we get into this year's data, tell us, what is Kids Count?
Sure. Well, Kids Count is actually a national initiative funded by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And our organization, the Child and Family Policy Center, is the Iowa grantee for that initiative. And so we've actually been involved for about 25 years gathering data on child well-being at the state and county level in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so tell us about this year's data, the data just released today. What do you see? What pops out?
Well, you know, we collect and have been collecting for, like I say, many years now, data on about 20 indicators of child well-being. We can see that many Iowa kids are actually doing pretty fine and really actually doing pretty great. But I think the data would also tell us that any complacency that Iowans might feel about how well we're supporting kids in our state is not merited necessarily either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we compare Iowa to other states, what do we see? Where in the pack are we, I guess,
sure,
is what I'm asking.
Well, and here's the complacency piece, and I think that's why we're really talking about that this year. On a lot of national indicators, Iowa does look pretty good. In addition to the state data that our shop puts out, we are part of the Casey Foundation's national push that pushes out data across states, and Iowa generally looks pretty good. I think in the last round of data, Iowa was ranked fourth among the states.
In terms of what?
In terms of about 16 indicators of child well-being, again, economics, family stability, health, community, and other family factors. So, and even as we compare, when we look at the variables we're releasing today, you know, we do look pretty good. I think what we want to say, our message is that those things are not, that is not untrue, but the story might be a little bit more complicated than the top line findings would say. Mm-hmm. For example, we talked about that, you know, 16% of Iowa kids who live in poverty, that is below the national average, which I think is around 21%. Iowa is a small state, but when you translate that number, that percentage, you know, 16%, it turns out to be about 110,000 kids in the state. And that's actually more than the entire population of Davenport, which I think is our third biggest city. So it, you know, a lot of Iowans, like, they hear these national numbers and the percentages sound pretty low, but when you really think about it in terms of absolute numbers, they are not insignificant.
Right, and these are each and every one individual lives, families growing up in poverty, if that would be the indicator. Let's talk about education. Comment on that, because of course we've had fights in the legislature over education funding. Do we see any reflection of that in the data?
Well, you know, Iowa's education numbers look pretty good. We actually measure four variables. If people at any point want to visit later on in the day, visit our website, they can do that. But the ones we track are preschool participation of 3- and 4-year-olds. Then we track 4th grade reading proficiency, 8th grade math proficiency, and then on-time high school graduation. And you know, our numbers look pretty good when you stack them up to the national averages. But what we are finding is that when you look at our rates of improvement, other states are making faster gains than we are.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Back to the complacency that you mentioned there at the outset. Let's say I'm an Iowa legislator and you want to give a message to me. What data are you going to give me a nod to in this year's data that this is something Iowa lawmakers might want to look at?
Sure. Well, you know, there's certainly, I think, health is an area, thinking around all of our public health insurance systems right now and all the discussion around Medicaid. Health is another area where Iowa has had fairly decent numbers. But on the other hand, we one of the numbers where we actually saw some deterioration since our baseline year, which was 2000, was in the share of births at low birth weight meaning under babies born at under 5.5 pounds, and there's actually been about a 10% decrease in that figure. I think we another area that we track is really around the use of public supports, you know, for families who are struggling to make ends meet, and we can see some areas where there's just based really reflecting the tough economic times that we're coming out of, big increases in the share of kids on free and reduced price meals at school. About 40% of mm-hmm. Iowa students are eligible for free or reduced price meals at school. Food assistance, we track the share of individuals who are eligible for food assistance, which is Iowa's SNAP, or formerly food stamps program. There's clearly still lag in the economy, and there's clearly still very much need out there as families are trying to keep ends meet. I know a lot of parents who are maybe working but not as many hours as they would like, or who aren't actively seeking jobs but would certainly love to get in the job market if it felt stronger. So I think those safety net opportunities for families continue to be real important as well.
Kids Count has been collecting data for many years, as you mentioned at the outset, and Iowa in those years has become much more diverse. When you look at this data in terms of race and ethnicity, do you see anything special there?
So I talked about the national rankings that Casey puts out every year, looking at child well-being across the states, and Iowa tends to be up in that top tier of counties.
Mm-hmm.
Casey, along with really our shop, I think has really tried to focus our attention more on a stronger kind of race equity lens. And so they put out about a year and a half ago a report where they did kind of the same exercise. It's an index, looked across 12 categories of child well-being across the states, but they broke it out by race and ethnicity. And I will tell you, Ben, the findings for Iowa looked quite different. So using that particular set of criteria, those 12 indicators, Iowa for all children ranked 7th. When you broke it out by race and ethnicity, for white non-Hispanic kids, Iowa ranked 17th. For Hispanic kids, 18th. For African American kids, Iowa ranked 30th among the states. And for Asian and Pacific Islander kids, Iowa ranked 33rd.
Mm-hmm. So we drop off as we get into some of the minority groups.
We do, and honestly, our ranking even for white non-Hispanic kids, 17th, I would call it pretty close to middle of the pack. And I think what that really reflects is the fact that Iowa, although it is becoming more diverse, and in fact much of our child population growth is due to growth in communities of color, but we are still a fairly white state. And so I think what this report I'm referencing, which was called Race for Results, really told us is that Iowa's overall high rankings on child well-being more reflect the homogeneity of our population, that we have a higher percentage than many other states mm-hmm. of white kids who on balance, on average, tend to look better on these indicators of child well-being more than we are doing a particularly good job supporting kids. And so it's an important caution as we talk about data that, again, that top line finding sometimes hides findings that are a bit more counterintuitive in a state where people tend to think we're doing a pretty good job for our kids.
Very interesting. Ann Disher, thank you very much. Communication Director, Senior Research Associate for the Child and Family Policy Center, just today issuing its latest Kids Count data on the well-being of Iowa children. And as you mentioned, you have a website. It's at cfpciowa.org. And you have rolled out a new web-based interactive interface where anyone can access these 20 indicators of child well-being, and that's at cfpciowa.org. Ann, thanks again.
It was a pleasure.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, winding up the hour with Rachel Caulfield. Rachel Payne Caulfield has led Drake University's Iowa Caucus Project since 2004, and in this role, she's organized candidate visits, also national presidential debates, and student opportunities over the past 4 campaign cycles. Rachel, of course, is one of our regular River to River political analysts, and she's just come out with a new book called The Iowa Caucus. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben.
We want to remind our listeners you are associate professor in the Department of Political Science and associate director of the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. So tell us, describe your take on the caucuses in this book. I have it right in front of me, but I want you to describe it.
Sure. Well, this is a pictorial history of the Iowa caucus. So the goal in putting the book together was really to provide a visually engaging way to understand what happens on the ground in the state of Iowa. And I think there are a lot of people out there who hear about Iowa, and maybe even people in Iowa, who don't fully appreciate the person-to-person contact that happens here. And so it provides a way to understand that, understand how the caucuses have evolved over time, particularly the rise of media, and give a personal connection to what this process is.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you think the national media, I have my own thoughts on this,
yeah.
the national media captures what you just described that is special about the Iowa caucuses.
Well, I think they try to, or some of them try to. But one of the things I've noticed since I've come to Iowa and been able to be involved in the process is that, you know, prior to being on the ground, I really had no idea what happens in Iowa. And so when I go to events and I meet with national media, I think there's a tendency to kind of turn cameras towards the candidate, do a few key man on the street interviews, and then leave the state.
Right. And what is the more that is being missed then?
Well, I think the more that is being missed is, you know, what's happening at these events? Who are these people who are there? And what drives them? What motivates them? I think, you know, for example, we can say Rick Santorum did a house party. But for those who have never actually attended a house party with a presidential candidate, it's kind of hard to envision what that looks like. It seems like something from a bygone era, right? Some nostalgic vision of what politics might have been once upon a time. But the fact that it actually happens in real time, it's happening today, it's happening all across the state of Iowa, that there are average everyday Americans sitting in a living room talking with a presidential candidate. Mm. And that's, I think, hard to believe for most people.
As you mentioned, this book, your book, The Iowa Caucus, A Pictorial History. Let's talk about some of the pictures. I certainly enjoyed paging through the pictures going way back to 1976. You have a picture of Jimmy Carter sitting on a sofa or something with Tom Harkin back
Absolutely.
In 1976. A very young-looking Barack Obama in 2007. It looks like he's on a school bus.
He is on a school bus. He was traveling with a group of college Democrats to an event here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. I think that was Waterloo, the caption
yep.
I saw there, too. Bob Dole petting a monkey, a monkey grinder at the Iowa.
I have to tell you, this image, I feel like this is kind of an iconic image of what happens in Iowa. And I looked high and low for that particular photo, and I was lucky enough to find it at the State Historical Society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You talked about house parties. We have several pictures of house parties. The one that comes to mind that you now that you mention it, Gary Hart in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. He's in at a house party at a looks like a well-to-do family.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a group gathered around, and he's standing in front of the fireplace chatting with voters.
Mm-hmm. We have the picture that really represents Bill Clinton is in one of these pictures. He's wearing a feed cap, and he's in a feed store, right? How much more Iowa caucuses do you need to be
That's
in that?
That's exactly right. Again, looking very young.
Right. And I was surprised. I saw a picture there. You picked out a full page picture of a straw poll. Now, we've seen the demise of the straw poll here in Iowa, but I was surprised to read that this photo dates from 1962.
Yeah, this is before our quote-unquote modern era of the Iowa caucus. I think a lot of people don't realize that what they see of the Iowa caucus now, it has its roots in a long history in Iowa. And that long history has always been about engaging people at a very local level. So I like the straw poll picture because I think it tells us something about who we are in Iowa. The fact that straw polls have always been used and have always been kind of a community event in Iowa. I think a lot of people miss the fact that caucuses have always always taken place in Iowa. We didn't just switch to a caucus in 1972. Iowa has always used a caucus system.
Mm-hmm. And they became of national prominence sort of almost by accident.
Yes, absolutely. So there was a change in the rules of the Democratic Party that followed the McGovern-Fraser Commission. The McGovern-Fraser Commission was set up after the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. And they proposed a set of rules changes for the Democratic Party, one of which was that if a state were to hold a caucus, they should be local caucuses. And the Iowa Democratic Party was already they were ahead of the curve on this, and they instituted a local caucus system. The people who organized that set up this four-stage system so that after the precinct caucuses, you go to the county conventions, to the district conventions, and then to the state convention. It was purely a logistical decision. They kind of counted backwards from the national convention, and they said, hey, how are we going to make this happen? There's, you know, we have to send out all this information, compile lists of delegates. Remember, this is the early 70s, so information had to actually be mailed out to the delegates. And so they started counting backwards, and as a result, Iowa had to go very, very early. And in 1972, we just happened to be first in the nation.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Caulfield, before we go, I want to have you comment on the changes that have taken place since many of the photos in this pictorial history in your book, going back to the 70s and even before. As you research caucuses, looking for photos, very telling photos about what it means to be here during the Iowa caucuses, what would you say have been the biggest changes or trends over the decades?
I think by far the biggest change that we've seen is the rise of national media in the caucus. And so, you know, this used to be, I think, something that was largely confined to the state, and those people in Iowa had a chance to see it, and those people outside of the state of Iowa, would have remained largely unaware of what was happening in Iowa. The fact that today, you know, last summer, we had major national media organizations covering candidates at the fair. So the national media, you know, is increasingly interested in what's happening in Iowa. And as a result, national polls and national coverage, I think, influences Iowa voters a whole lot more than it used to.
Mm-hmm. Where do you come down on this question? And I guess I can guess that you're employed by Drake University, a mm-hmm. very well-known Iowa private university here. But we always have the question of, you know, does Iowa deserve its first of the nation status, especially when we consider that in diversity, for instance, it does sure. not reflect the nation at large.
Yeah, I'm kind of an unapologetic advocate of the Iowa caucus. And again, you know, I think those of us who are lucky enough to live in Iowa, it's kind of hard to argue against the caucus. But
right.
we're very, very fortunate. But I think that there are, you know, if we look at the system as a whole, and if we accept the premise that some state has to go first, every state is going to have quirks. Every state is going to be different than the population in some way. And so I think there are actually a lot of things that recommend Iowa as first in the nation, one of which is that I think there are very few states in 2016, and I think there will be even fewer going forward, that can boast a competitive political environment. A truly competitive political environment where both Democrats and Republicans have strong party bases. And within each party, you have a wide range of ideologies. So really any candidate can come to Iowa and they can find a base of support in Iowa. They can go door to door. They can meet voters. And sometimes, you know, those who might be considered the least likely can actually get a foothold here among the voters. That includes Barack Obama. That includes Mike Huckabee.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Winner of the 2008 caucus.
That's right. And Rick Santorum.
Right. Finally, in the last minute we have, I want to give you a hypothetical. I know politicians hate hypotheticals,
yeah,
but neither you or I are politicians, so we can throw this one out. We meet in an elevator. We don't know each other, Rachel, and
sure.
you say, are you going to the caucuses? I say, nah, I can't be bothered with that. You have a minute or 30 seconds. I'm looking at the clock. I think
yeah.
you got almost a minute to convince me that the Iowa caucuses as an Iowan are really worth taking part in.
Absolutely. So One of the things that I think is most special about what we do here in Iowa is the fact that, you know, politics is about us. It's not about fancy people in Washington, D.C. who are far away and kind of apart from our everyday lives. Politics should be and can be about average everyday people, about the concerns that we have, and about bringing those concerns into the political process. And I think it is not only our incredible good fortune to be able to do that in a very tangible way, but it is also our responsibility to do it because so few people across the country have that opportunity.
Okay. Rachel, you don't sound at all. When it comes to politics, we're always saying, oh, it's jaded, jaundiced.
No.
But you're hopeful.
In fact, I dedicate the book to the people of Iowa who I think have the capacity to restore our faith in the political system.
Okay. Check it out. Rachel Caulfield's latest book, The Iowa Caucus, A Pictorial History of This Institution, which the latest installment of which happens in just a few days. Rachel, thank you very much of Drake University.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, this evening, Pints and Politics, a special event in Cedar Rapids tonight. You can listen to that tomorrow at this time. It'll include Todd Dorman and James Lynch at the Gazette, along with Jennifer Hemmingson. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow at this time. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.